part of worship service. Except in some of the westernized forms of Buddhism, that is also true of Buddhism. What is more typical is something that is called a Dharma talk. Dharma here referring to teaching, and it's basically a teaching talk. This, however, is a sermon for one very simple reason, and that is that because I have not officially received Dharma transmission from any of the many lineages that have come down through Buddhist history, I am not authorized or qualified to give a Dharma talk. So this is a sermon. Interesting differences, though. I remember, as clearly as if it were yesterday, what initially sparked my interest in Buddhism, beyond the fact that I had a world religions cognate in graduate school, because that looked like the best way for me to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish in graduate school. It was an old classroom in Furman Hall, and I can still hear the deep drawl, the voice of the professor who hailed from the deep south of Georgia. He was talking about the Four Noble Truths. To review very briefly what many of you know already, these four foundational Buddhist statements include: all of life is marked by suffering. The cause of that suffering is our selfish tendencies to put our own desires before those of others and to act in ways that separate us rather than unite us. In pretty much logical order, then, to lessen or eliminate the suffering, the key is to overcome our tendencies to do that. And then Buddhism proposes its distinctive path of eight practices that include both attitudes and practices, include both morality and meditation. But let's go back to the first one, because that's what caught my attention. Suffering was something I knew about. As most of you know, I grew up in a family that pretty much defined the term dysfunctional. At the time I was introduced to the Four Noble Truths, I was separated from my then husband, raising a somewhat challenging daughter. She would agree with that. As an utterly unprepared single mom, working and trying to put myself through grad school while living in an unfamiliar city, in an unfamiliar state, on a frayed shoestring budget. Never mind that the suffering the Buddha referred to was not in the first instance this overt kind of distress. He had something deeper and more finely nuanced in mind. The gloom that creeps into our lives as surely as the sun rises and sets. No matter how good life is, no matter how great our life is going, we're aware, if we allow ourselves to be maybe in the dark recesses of night at 2 or 3 in the morning, we're aware that something is out of joint. The word that is translated usually, suffering, comes from a Pali word that means, has to do with a wheel on an ox cart being out of joint. So if you think about driving a car with a tire or a wheel out of alignment, or the steady drip of a leaky faucet, I think that's kind of thing that's intended here. It's simply an aspect of life, of all lives, and none of us escapes it. So how does this get incorporated into the Buddhist tradition? Well, there's another list of four, and it's the legend or the story of the four passing sights. It essentially points to how the Buddha, or young Prince Siddhartha, because he was not yet the Buddha, how he set off and the experiences he had that led to his becoming the Buddha. That story, at least for me, comes with a caveat. If we're even to begin to grasp the meaning of it, we have to give the storyteller credit for the premise upon which the story is based, even though it seems outlandish, as it does to me. Especially in the age of the internet, the premise of this tale seems way too far-fetched to even be credible. But hang in there with the author, whomever that might have been, and allow him his starting point, which was that young Siddhartha he'd grown to adulthood totally, utterly, and completely sheltered from anything that might have disturbed him. I mean, if ever somebody was wrapped in bubble wrap, he was, according to this version of the tale, anyhow. But for all the good, for all the pleasures, apparently for all of the dancing maidens and so forth that he had at his disposal, he grew restless, as young men will do, and he set out in his chariot with his charioteer in a series of three excursions outside the palace walls. He encountered an old person, apparently from the descriptions, a very old person. Then a seriously ill person on another. These are three separate trips outside the palace. As such stories tend to go, they're repeated in pretty formulaic fashion. He encountered an old person and then a very, very seriously ill person. Finally, a corpse wrapped in a shroud and surrounded by flies. In each case, he inquired of his charioteer if such was the fate of only those people, or if indeed that was going to happen to everybody. The charioteer, clearly an accomplice in this whole scene, assures him that such fates befall all of us, Siddhartha included. So just imagine this poor young man who had never, never, ever encountered anything unpleasant, and suddenly, age, illness, death, dumped on him all at once, pretty much. He was shaken to his core. He set out alone and on foot, uncertain about what to do next. Then we get to what then is incorporated as the fourth of the passing sites. He encountered a wandering sadhu, a Hindu holy man, who had withdrawn from the world with which Gautama had become so disillusioned. At that time in India's history, there would have been wandering holy men all over, a very common sight. So his coming across one would not have been unusual. Nor was his decision unusual to become a solitary seeker of enlightenment, especially for Hindus in the upper echelons of society, and the Buddha grew up a Hindu before he became the Buddha. Especially for Hindus in the upper echelons of society, this was a common path to follow. As the story continues to unfold, the Buddha followed a similar path of withdrawing from the world and eventually went on to found a religion which, interestingly to me, I've always been kind of fascinated by this little wrinkle in the Buddhist tradition. For quite a while after its founding, made no provision whatsoever for practitioners other than those who chose to completely withdraw from the world and live in monasteries, where they spent a lot of time in contemplation and study and meditation. It was only later in the tradition that Buddhism developed as a path for those of us who everyday lives are lived out in the world rather than in a monastery. As Buddhism evolved and developed, both the monastic traditions and the Buddhism in daily life traditions, for those of you familiar with the terminology, the Theravada or Way of the Elders and the Mahayana or the bigger raft both developed alongside each other. And both continue to thrive today, both in other places and in the United States and Europe. Okay, we don't live in palaces from which we venture out to learn hard truths about a world from which we've been completely sheltered. But we're all exposed to things on a daily basis that shake us in a way that seems to me similar, at least, to what Siddhartha experienced. This morning's reading is but one example. The wrenching, emotional whiplash of both the joy and the promise of life and the peril and fear and anguish of it as it plays out in the African American community today. The Pulse nightclub shootings are yet another example. Random shootings seem to have become an endless feature of modern life. A speeding truck plows into revelers at a Bastille Day celebration in Nice. Little kids are left alone in a desert as punishment. Anti-Muslim vitriol abounds, along with hatred directed at LGBTQ people and African Americans, as well as police officers. Then there's a recent coup attempt in Turkey. Huge numbers of people live with food insecurity, and on and on. And it's all right in our living rooms, as close as our smartphone or our tablet. Clearly, we live in an imperfect world, a world in which people die, in which hearts get broken, in which wars are fought, and in which people die from hunger and disease in overwhelming numbers, in which people are shot because of the color of their skin or whom they love. When people are labeled terrorists because of how they look, how they speak. Ours is a world that is saddening, sometimes overwhelming, and frightening. That's before we even get to the things that assault our own spirits, the things that go on in our own lives. All in all, Buddhism's teachings and practices help me to live my imperfect life in this imperfect world, to some measure, at least accepting it for what it is, and not wasting my energy and increasing my pain by wishing it were otherwise. As I observed to somebody a while back, it'd be better at that if I were a better Buddhist than I am, but that's another issue. Hopefully then the energy thus freed up can be better used to work toward necessary changes. What I find in Unitarian Universalism is encouragement not only to accept, and I hope I'm not splitting hairs and playing with pieces here, encouragement to accept this world, but to embrace it. To embrace it precisely in its pain and its imperfections, its finitude and its ugliness. We can embrace our world and our lives, the whole entire messy thing, without the in spite of. The other thing I've found in our faith, and the other place where our UU tradition complements my Buddhist leanings, the other thing I found, and especially here in this beloved community that meets within these walls, is community. Religion has always been about community for me. Sometimes I think it's been primarily about community. Even in Christian churches, in which to varying extents I felt like a semi-outsider because I couldn't accept much of the teaching, I thrived on the community. I was fortunate because I always somehow managed to find churches that were okay with my being on the fringes doctrinally. Sometimes I think they were even rather pleased to have a token heretic in their midst. I know of one for sure that was. That applied to seminary as well, even, although I graduated from a Methodist seminary. As long as I was honest about my search, no one expected me to toe any official line. In fact, there were people who very much encouraged me to find and follow my own path. What's different here, of course, is that I found community without having to accept token heretic status. And that has been, to say that has been good is an understatement. I think it's a little bit difficult, I've thought of this off and on, I think it's a little bit difficult to be a UU heretic, but I'm working on that. The East Central Indiana Mindfulness Sangha, the Buddhist group of which I was a founding member way back when, was my spiritual community for several years. Our rhythm of biweekly meetings for meditation, Dharma study, and a meal had sufficed well. Eventually, though, enough people moved away that continuing as a Sangha was no longer possible, and we officially disbanded. In addition, as circumstances in my own life changed, I found that I wanted more. I wanted all the stuff that goes with a church, the gathering together for worship, the classes, the music, the potlucks, the more diverse community of people and views and expectations. Community also helps me to embrace my imperfect life in this imperfect world. It's cliche, yes, but having a community to celebrate life's joys and sorrows with and to wrap its arms around me in times of sorrow and concern encourages me to embrace all of my life, knowing that I am surrounded by its care and support. For me, in short, Unitarian Universalism augments Buddhism by its encouragement to life in this world, messy as it is, and by its vibrant community. It is indeed my Sangha.